Tickets are now on sale for Side by Side, Union Gallery's annual major fundraiser. Join us on Saturday, February 8th for an afternoon of live music, artsy activities, and a lottery-style draw where everyone is a winner. Take home a one-of-a-kind artwork and support Union Gallery's nonprofit mission. Come visit the exhibition or check out the online catalog to see the 100-plus works available. Head to uniongallery.ca and get your tickets for Side by Side today.
Cold weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Starting tomorrow, Springer Market Square will be transformed by Spirit of Winter, a new downtown BIA event in collaboration with local artists. Spirit of Winter is a new event in the heart of downtown, running from February 1st to 17th, with features including an enchanted forest to stroll through, fire pits, free horse-drawn wagon rides, and skating. Jaylene Cardinal and Dakota Ward are Cree artists who have been based in Kingston since 2014, establishing their business WC Creatives, which offers native jewelry, crafts, fashion, and art. Their story, The Bear in Me, will be central to Spirit of Winter, being told in English, French, Cree, and Ojibwe with video projections on City Hall and the Bank of Montreal throughout every evening until February 17th. Cardinal and Ward stopped by CFRC to discuss The Bear in Me and its place in Spirit of Winter.
To start us off, I was wondering if you could just get into how this collaboration with the BIA kind of came to be.
Well, it actually started out with a piece that we did in 2023 with Wawatake. And it was to showcase Indigenous stories, Indigenous language, and art, because in our culture, what we do in the winter times is share stories. And it kind of grew from there. The story that Dakota wrote was it was very cute.
Yeah, no, I just wrote a story that speaks on the differences in the nature of certain beings that regarded to winter. And I wanted to sort of spread a message of understanding the differences of someone else sort of thing, to show how we all see things differently and we all respond to things differently. And if we give each other a chance to understand each other, even something as far as a cardinal to a bear could still get along and understand and grow each other mentally and spiritually.
You gave us a bit of a preview there, but I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into The Bear in Me and the process of putting that story together.
Yeah, well, the process was really like, I do a lot of writing at home as like a script writer or just poetry, rap songs, all kinds of stuff. So I sat down and I just really wanted to write something that represented me and Jaylene, because they always say, write what you know best. So my mother used to always call me Coda Bear. So I decided, oh, a bear, right? And then Jaylene's last name is Cardinal. So I decided a cardinal. And then I kind of bounced off that. And then the message we're always trying to, well, me and her as individuals, we're always trying to learn from any culture we can. You know, we're kind of like the cardinal learning from the bear a lot of the times. We're could be Ojibwe, Mohawk, you know, Cree. It doesn't matter. And just every culture along the board. So we like to be like that. So that's what I wanted to express, that understanding everyone's differences, because that's what makes us stronger as people, you know, because we're not just the culture or the race that we are. We're humanity. So that's what I was trying to express.
Mm-hmm. And then his story also it opens the door for other people to understand the way we think, you know, our culture, our teaching, certain things. So we're just kind of opening a door there for open-mindedness.
For us as people, like individuals ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is by all means a multimedia project. I was wondering if you could speak about the process of putting all those different pieces together.
Yes, yeah, so we're actually working with a company out of Toronto called Ava Animations. And the whole process has been really, really amazing to see just a piece of art, a simple piece of art, come to life. The movements, the personality, you know, all of my elements of my painting come to life. It's been really, really awesome.
Really fun to watch, yes.
They did an amazing job.
For sure. And then there's the audio element as well. Did you record it? Did you have voice actors?
Yeah, so I tried to make the music myself, and then I realized, like, with a software program, and then I realized, you know what, no, this needs real instruments, you know, real people playing it to bring that humanity to it. So I got my business partner, Michael, and my son, who has always been good at playing guitar. Ever since he picked one up, he could play it. And Michael can play, like, I don't know how many instruments. So I connected these guys together, and I sat there with them and sort of just gave them the feel of what my story was about. It was supposed to be a very heavily cute kind of vibe. And they sat there, and we all just kind of made the music together and did it in the most creative way we could.
And what does it mean for you guys to have this project be front and center right in Springer Market Square for the next few weeks?
Oh my God. Well, it means a lot to me personally because I was born here in Kingston. I grew up in Edmonton, but ever since I moved back to Kingston, it was like a full circle effect. And so many, it's like my dreams are just kind of coming true. So I just gained this courage to just sort of chase it. And me and Jaylene do that together. So not only does that help us as people, but in our relationship as well. So for me personally, when I see something like that be projected to hopefully thousands of people, it's like the power of the work that we put in, but also the people that we are, you know, because for a lot of times I felt powerless as a person growing up, not just as an Indigenous person, but also just as a person in general. I didn't have a lot of confidence. So things like this for me personally just blow me through the roof. I don't really have too many words for it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It means a lot to me too, because I didn't really grow up with my culture, and you know, seeing this on something as big as the City Hall is like just heart filling. Also too, just hearing there's going to be traditional language along with it, hearing those, you know, those words is really, it just lifts my heart up so much.
It's true, and I didn't grow up too like traditional myself, so we're kind of students at the whole thing. That's why I said we like to learn about all kinds of different cultures, because we kind of just grew up how we were. Like the only culture we had was from our neighborhoods and our friends, you know, in Edmonton. So we're taking this chance to learn and evolve as people, but at the same time express it to everybody else so that they can hopefully evolve and learn alongside us, because we're right there with them.
Hmm. Yeah. And then also too, there's been a couple comments of people who've seen the promo and stuff, and them saying how happy and proud they are that their culture and their language is being shared. Really, that's amazing in itself.
That's very important to us, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have the big opening event this weekend. What are you looking forward to? What are you hoping folks can take away from that?
I'm hoping that they're gonna walk away with an open heart, and just feeling connected.
Yeah, I'm hoping the families go down there and they just have a really nice, magical evening and enjoy winter when it's, you know, in its coldest, and everyone just has a moment that they remember. And if there's anything I hope they take away from the story and the artwork, is to show that, you know, reconciliation is a bridge that's built by two different people, and they just need to give each other the chance to cross it. And yeah, that's all I hope for.
And where can folks find you guys and all your projects, all the art you're doing?
So we usually just work from online. We do projects from Toronto and Ottawa, but I would say online would be the best way to
Yeah, Facebook, our Facebook page. We're mm-hmm. working on a website right now. And but yeah, Facebook, WC Creatives. Check us out. Follow us there. Instagram. Yeah, we're always doing something new, so you never know what to expect. It's not always just paintings. We do all kinds of stuff, from movies to music to, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It'll, we like to keep it interesting because we get bored ourselves.
Once again, that was local artists Dakota Ward and Jaylene Cardinal, whose story The Bear and Me will be featured in Springer Market Square until February 17th. As Cardinal and Ward mentioned, the launch of Spirit of Winter tomorrow will also be the debut of The Bear and Me, with traditional greetings and a smudging ceremony led by the Indigenous community and remarks from federal and municipal leaders accompanying the display. Jan McDonald with the Downtown BIA also spoke with CFRC about Spirit of Winter as a whole.
Where did this idea for Spirit of Winter come from?
So we used to, years ago, have a winter festival called The Fest, which was very popular and ran for years and years and years. Over the last couple of years, especially since COVID, we've had sort of a difficult time with weather. So, you know, we would sort of plan weather activities and then, you know, the rink would go down or we would get, you know, warmer temperatures and we couldn't keep snow. And so what we were doing was kind of looking for something that was a bit weatherproof so that we could still have, you know, sort of a fun winter festival, but we weren't so much relying on, you know, ice and snow and that sort of thing. So we started looking at light festivals, which are very, very popular in Europe. And that's kind, we sort of kept that in our back pocket for a long time. And then when we were lucky enough to receive grant funding from the federal government, we were like, okay, this is the time. So that's sort of how it all started.
And as you mentioned at the start there, this month is usually quite quiet for Kingston. What are you hoping this project brings to downtown?
I think, you know, like anyone else this time of year, we're a little bit housebound. We're looking for things to get us out. We're feeling a little bit claustrophobic. We need a reason to get out. And I think that this is a beautiful opportunity to just, you know, get out of the house, get downtown, embrace the fact that we're living in, you know, a colder climate, but it can be actually really beautiful. And so, you know, we really just wanted, something that people could sort of celebrate, get them downtown, you know, get them around a fire pit or on the ice skating. And then they've got the backdrop of this, a beautiful, beautiful story. So, that was sort of the motivation was, you know, Kingston still has a lot to offer and downtown Kingston still has a lot to offer, even, you know, in those seasons when it's not sort of heavy tourists. So,
Yeah. And you have your opening event this weekend. What are you looking forward to there?
Yeah, it's going to be beautiful. So, it starts at 6:15 on Saturday evening. So we're working with the local Indigenous community, and they are going to be doing a lot of sort of ceremonial things with the opening. So we've got, you know, a smudging ceremony, we've got music and dance and Indigenous food, and then the premiere of The Bear and Me, which is the story that will be projected onto City Hall and the Bank of Montreal, will be sort of the culmination of the night, and we're going to be seeing it in four languages. So it'll be screened in Cree, Ojibwe, French, and English. And then from there, the regular rotation will happen. But I think it's just going to be like a beautiful night.
The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is returning for their 25th year with more local films on the docket than ever before. KCFF 2025 will present 5 Made in Kingston films, the most ever, at the festival next month, in addition to 8 short films produced through their local shorts program. This will also mark the world premiere for many of these films. This comes as Kingston's film sector is potentially on the cusp of some major growth. Ambitious actors in Kingston's film scene have been pioneering a new era, which includes an emphasis on homegrown start-to-finish productions and possibly a brand new film studio in town for this purpose before the year is up. Festival director Mark Garness spoke with CFRC about this year's elevated local film presence. This is the most local films to be featured at KCFF. I was wondering if you could speak to that and what it says about Kingston's film industry.
Yeah, well, I think when I started, my first year at the festival was 2000, and I started in 2012. My first festival was 2013, and we didn't have any local features that year. And it was in those early days for me, it was very rare to even see a local feature. We would maybe get one like every other year type thing, but we had a local shorts program, which is all is that's been here for 25 years, and it's always been a really strong program. oftentimes it's a lot of film students at Queens creating those films. But one thing I've noticed is just more filmmakers living here year round and in the community making films. So I think like through Queens, there's always been a strong output of short films, but now we're seeing more shorts being created by people in the community. And then also the big thing I'm noticing is more features now. So like this year we have, I think we have four locally produced features. And last year, I think we had three. So now it seems like year in, year out, we have a few features being made by Kingstonians, which was something I didn't see in my early days.
Mm-hmm. And has it been a kind of like a slow progression to get here, did you find, or was there kind of a big boom of local filmmaking?
Yeah, I would say it was more gradual. Like, I think when I started, it was just like, yeah, like I said, it was very rare to see a local feature. And then, I don't know, one year we maybe had two, and then one year we had three. And so it's kind of been gradual. And Kingston had its, got a film office. I think it was in 2019. So that certainly helped. And Alex was the original film officer as well. So, and he's maintains a close connection to the festival to this day, and has been on the board and was the early director as well. So I know he's when he was in that role, was always looking up for the festival as well. So yeah, I think now with more supports in place, like the film office, and then I think also locals knowing that there is a exhibition space for their films if they do create one, like knowing that KCFF will play them, I think is both those things have led to a higher output.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the 25th anniversary. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the festival's growth and how that's kind of coincided or had a relationship with our local film industry growth till now.
Yeah, like it's so every year I've been with the festival, like other than the pandemic years, which just is not really a comparable, but every like I guess non compromised festival has grown in attendance. And you know, just tying it back to the local stuff, I think anytime you can include a local film or more local talent in the lineup, it's bringing in people that may not show up otherwise. So you know, for example, like we have an 18 millimeter program, which is youth filmmakers, and you know, they're bringing up mom and dad and brother and sister and friends and family that are there to support their kid, and they are often coming to the festival for the first time through that path. And then I think once they're there, they're like, oh, there's a lot more to this festival than I realized, and you know, maybe I'll go check out another film. So it's been, I think, including some of the local productions has been a way to provide a new point of entry into the festival for some people who've maybe known about it but have never actually taken a chance on it. So that's not why we do it, to grow the festival. We do it to support the local filmmakers, but it is a nice byproduct of including more local, is that I think our core audience does grow.
Garnis also included one of the local films in his highlights for this upcoming festival.
It's a tie between many things, but I would say Single Woman Seeking Child is one that I'm excited for, but also proud of. We had a 25th anniversary contest last year. It was a script reading contest where we had five people do live pitches in front of a jury, and Blaine Waters was the filmmaker who won. So we helped fund his new short film that's going to be playing at the festival this year. And yeah, it was all shot in Kingston. So you'll see like lots of downtown familiar landmarks, and it's a story about his family and him growing up here. And it's only 15 minutes, but he nailed it. It's amazing. It's got like the arc of like a full 90 minute feature film. I don't know if his intention is to make it into a feature or not. Like, it's pretty hot off the press. Yeah, I know he's bringing his family over to the premiere at the festival. And so, yeah, it was just nice to be involved in it going back to last festival, and knowing that we had a hand in bringing this to life by funding it and then now premiering it at the festival. So I guess if I was forced to pick one, that would be the one I'm looking most forward to.
Once again, that was Mark Garnis, Executive Director of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, on this year's record number of local productions being featured.
The Kingston Canadian Film Festival has announced that the award-winning documentary Blue Rodeo, Lost Together will be the closing night film on Sunday, March 2nd. This screening will bring Blue Rodeo co-founder and Queen's University alumnus Jim Cuddy back to Kingston alongside co-founder Greg Keeler and director Dale Heslip. Cuddy and Keeler narrate the film, telling the story of Toronto band Blue Rodeo from their beginnings to their current status as one of Canada's most cherished bands. In anticipation of the event, we spoke with Jim Cuddy and director Dale Heslip about what festival attendees can expect.
What can audiences expect from this film closing out KCFF this year?
I think it's fantastic that it's closing the Kingston Film Festival. I think it's fantastic that Jim and Greg went to Queen, so it's going to have this sort of this emotional connection, because it kind of all started there. It started on a car ride going from Kingston to Toronto, and they decided to make a band, and they've been together ever since. So we've been getting a lot of really great reaction to the film, and it played at the Whistler Film Festival in December. It played at the Salt Spring Film Festival just last week. It's playing the Hot Docs Theater Saturday night, sold out. Jim, Greg, myself, and Erica M are going to do a Q&A. Then it's doing Cineplex across the country, like 38 theaters across the country, February 2 and 3, before it comes to Kingston. So I don't know. The ticket sales have been going crazy. There's obviously a ton of Blue Rodeo fans out there. And I don't know. We really like it. I have to say, when we heard that the band liked the doc after we sent it to them, I was like, yes, thank God. But the fans have been reacting the same way. There's a real nice honesty to this doc, and it's a really nice way to get to know the band, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Jim, how is it for you to be, you know, reflecting back?
It was a real joy to go down memory lane. To do the doc, but it also uncovered some uncomfortable times. I mean, I think in a 40 years span, life together, there are going to be some difficult times, and maybe those times were a little more difficult than I remembered. And so it was good to drop my suppressed guard and just take things for the way they were, because now they're good. And so it's easier to look back on the difficult times when times are rosy. It's amazing. I think that Greg and I started as high school friends. And so I think that for any of this to have happened to us would be unimaginable. I think we both realized at a certain time we wanted to absorb ourselves in music for the rest of our lives. But whether we were going to be able to do that or not, who knew? And so to find ourselves here, even talking about a documentary, is full of gratitude and wonder.
Cuddy also dove into his time at Queen's prior to Blue Rodeo and his roots in Kingston.
Right. Well, I graduated from Queen's in 78, and Greg picked me up, and I told him that I wanted to devote 1 year to music, and then I would go to law school or something. And he said, well, let's get a band. And so from that car ride till now, we've had a band. So we planned a band. We got a band called the Hi-Fis. That played for about 3 years in Toronto. Then we moved to New York, and we had a band down there when my wife, girlfriend at the time, went to acting school. And it wasn't until we came back to Toronto in 84 and got the rodeo together in 85. So that had been, you know, I'd been out of school 7 years at that point. And it wasn't until that point that we got this band that we thought, wow, this is a really good band. I mean, we had Cleve and Basil, and then we had Bobby Wiseman. And I think no matter what had happened to us, we would have been happy that that band was so good and played our song so well. So, and then it goes from there, but that we had a very strong start. After 7 years of, you know, of meandering, we had a very strong start when we had finally got Blue Rodeo together.
Well, how does it feel to be returning to Kingston after all these years?
Well, I love Kingston, and I probably play there once a year. Like my roots in Kingston go way back. My parents went to Queens. My dad came there. My mom was from Prince Edward County, so she obviously wanted to go to Queens and wanted to get out of Prince Edward County. And my dad came as a war vet, and they met and they married, and then they had their life, had their kids, they divorced. And then when we were young parents, when I was a young parent with my wife, my parents went back to Queens and remarried. So that's two marriages. My wife and I met at Queens, and now our youngest son, who just married his girlfriend, they met at Queens well. So we're three generations and four marriages, one couple twice.
Yeah, so it must feel special to kind of, you know, be returning for this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I loved it. I loved it in Kingston. I love my years in Queens, and I love going back. There's something very inspiring about it. There's something very tranquil about it. And yet there's a lot of energy on the campus, and it's not too bro for me. And it's a great place.
Once again, that was co-founder of band Blue Rodeo, Jim Cuddy, and director Dale Heslip on the documentary Blue Rodeo Lost Together, closing out KCFF this year. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Friday, January 31st, we will see sunny conditions, but it still will be cold with a daytime high of minus 11. Saturday, February 1st, we're going to see a daytime high of 2 degrees, dropping down to minus 11 overnight. Sunday, February 2nd, we'll see a high of 4 degrees with a 45% chance of precipitation. And then Monday, February 3rd, we'll see a daytime high of 3 with a low around the 0 mark. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, January 27th, 2025. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles and Edwin to Princess expect delays while a contractor completes phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard at Elmwood, expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. With a strike deadline rapidly approaching, Queen's University and workers are still in the midst of negotiations. Five bargaining units provided notice of a strike deadline earlier this month after initial talks failed to yield an agreement. These groups represent approximately 1,000 workers at the university, including food services, library workers, tradespeople, classroom and laboratory technicians, and custodians and caretakers. With talks ongoing, job action will be possible on Monday, February 3rd, 2025. Steve Seneschal, president of QP229, representing trades workers, food service workers, caretakers, custodians, grounds personnel, parking, and bylaw officers, stopped by CFRC to provide an update on bargaining as the strike deadline approaches. As you mentioned before, we're getting down to the wire in terms of negotiations. Where are you at now? How's it going?
We're still actively trying to sort out a deal and work with the university to get something that we're all happy with. And we have upcoming bargaining dates. The other TP units have ongoing dates as well. And we're hoping we all get a deal before the deadline. But if not, we're ready.
And have you had that wage discussion yet, or is that going to be at the tail end?
The university has handed over some wage proposals, and they're not acceptable thus far. And that's why we're continuing to be ready for our strike action if necessary.
I mean, as you mentioned, the offers so far have not been acceptable for you. Do you foresee a change in the coming week, or do you think a strike is fairly inevitable at this point?
I mean, we're hoping that the university realizes that wages have fallen extremely far behind due to inflation, due to the 1% cap that most of us had to experience that was illegally legislated. They've refused to come back to the table prior to our contracts expiring to renegotiate wages. They wanted to just take their chances, I guess. So here we are, and that's one of the main struggles in this round of bargaining is securing redress for Bill 124. The current mood is it's a 50-50 chance. They need to come to the table with something a lot more significant.
How will this impact
things for students, professors, everyone going about their day at the university?
Well, for my unit, specifically 2290, obviously nothing will be clean. The bathrooms will probably be unusable within a relatively short amount of time. Buildings may be cold if there's no one to keep the heat on. Sidewalks and entryways may be slippery if we don't have grounds crews to maintain those. But additionally, if we're looking at the other QP units as well, 254 represents lab technicians, so labs may be canceled. 1302 represents library technicians and archivists, and libraries may be closed or have reduced capacity to serve students.
The latest update from the university's labor news page on January 29th states, quote, should the parties be unable to reach agreements, the university respects the union's right to strike and the right of employees in QP Locals 229, 1302, and 254 to participate in the strike. The university also updated their frequently asked questions page this week, stating, quote, negotiations are ongoing and we remain cautiously optimistic that if both sides commit to working hard through the week and weekend, deals can be found that are fair for everyone and can be ratified by both sides. They also added contingency plan information in the event of a strike to the page, clarifying that the university will remain open and classes and academic activities, including classes taught in a lab, are expected to continue. All currently booked events on campus through February 14th will continue, and that food services will remain open in a reduced capacity. Just over a year after coming together, not-for-profit vocal ensemble The Isabel Voices will be representing Canada overseas in just a few months. After their first performance in November 2023, the ensemble was contacted by Vox Anima London and offered a concert residency at the Ely Cathedral in the UK in June 2025. The piece at the center of their first show was Dan Forest's Breath of Life, which they will also be performing at the Cathedral. This Sunday, February 2nd, the group will be performing the Canadian premiere of Dan Forest's newest work, Creation, at the Isabel Bader Centre before bringing the composition with them to the UK. CFRC spoke with artistic director Daryl Christie at the rehearsal earlier this week about their debut of Creation this weekend and the upcoming trip this summer. You're getting ready for a concert this weekend where you'll be debuting your performance of Creation. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are thrilled to be presenting what is going to be the Canadian premiere of this work this weekend at the Isabel Bader Centre for the Performing Arts. This piece is called Creation, and it really celebrates all things about our world, whether that's through like a spiritual context or a humanist context or an environmental context. It really is a celebration of all things that really make up this beautiful planet that we live on and share. And it's such a joyous and deeply moving and triumphant work. We've got 50 singers in the ensemble, along with 22 instrumentalists on stage and two soloists. And it is 72 minutes of what I think will be a epic and beautiful performance on Sunday.
And this is part of your sort of wind up for your trip abroad this summer. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that and how you're feeling about this trip coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. So the piece that we're performing, Creation, is actually the piece we've also been invited to sing in Ely Cathedral in Cambridge in this coming summer. And we were invited by the composer to be part of this project as he heard our first performance as the Isabel Voices back in October. 2023 now, I guess it was.
That was your first ever performance?
Our first ever performance when we sang another one of Dan Forest's pieces called The Breath of Life. And so it's wonderful that we were able to open our organization with a piece of his music. And now that his music has become so connected to us as an organization, that we have the opportunity to not only sing Creation when we go to the UK, but we've been asked as well to open the performance with The Breath of Life, just the Isabel Voices giving a solo performance of that. So it's going to be a really exciting summer for us, and we're delighted to be able to give the Canadian premiere of this piece before we take it on the road.
And
And I mean, you're quite a young group, so it must have been really big news for you guys to know you're going abroad so soon.
Yeah, absolutely. The Isabel Voices was born out of a smaller choir and has kind of evolved and become a much larger organization. And yeah, to be contacted after just our first concert and saying how delighted they were with the performance and inviting us to go to the UK was a real honor for sure. And we're delighted. Delighted.
Yeah, I guess this says a lot about the talent we have here in Kingston.
We are so lucky here in Kingston. We have so many wonderful, talented musicians and singers and a real appreciation of music in our community. There are so many different musical groups and ventures, and we are truly blessed to have this beautiful place in which to call home here at the Isabel. So yeah, we are. I think Kingston's doing it right.
And you gave a bit of a description of what folks can expect from Creation debuting this weekend. But what can folks expect at the show this weekend?
Yeah, so it's a 72-minute piece that's 12 movements. And each movement kind of has a very different feel to it. We've got moments that feel like a jig, like this really energetic kind of kitchen party. There are movements which feel very space-like, I would say, as we kind of, it always feels like we leave Earth and go into the heavens or into the planets. There are some beautiful solos being sung by Kathleen Radke and Mark Wilkinson, who are joining us for the performance. And yeah, just some really, really, really standout music. It is certainly a piece of music that will keep you entertained over the course of an hour, for sure.
Once again, that was Artistic Director Daryl Christie with the Isabel Voices. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative. A group of local artists and community members staged a demonstration at Monday's Mayor's Arts Awards asking for Mayor Brian Patterson to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. The group has called themselves Artists for Liberation and described their collective mission as gathering to, quote, address the ongoing genocide in Palestine. While the demonstration was meant to be kept under wraps until Monday night's award ceremony in Memorial Hall, the plans were leaked to city staff prior to the event. Announcers at the Mayor's Arts Awards let the crowd know that there would be a demonstration at the end of the ceremony in their closing remarks. 13 members of the group wearing patches reading Liberation for All on their shirts stood and shared the following words with the audience at the end of the ceremony.
We are a group of artists local to Powder Rock and Kingston who understand art is not only a source of creativity and innovation, but is a catalyst for social change and justice. We know that art and culture are a part of politics and not a part of government. Thus, it is our collective responsibility as artists to meaningfully engage in our communities, locally and globally, and to amplify the voices of other artists who cannot express themselves freely, such as those in Palestine. Tonight, we are here to celebrate the artists receiving awards today. We honor them for what they are doing for their communities. We are also here to voice our support for the Palestinian struggle for freedom, for justice, and for equality. We now ask Mayor Brian Patterson to take action and to call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Palestine as mayors of Toronto, Hamilton, Mississauga, Montreal, Edmonton, Victoria, and over 50 other leaders in Canada already have done. We will now invite you all to take action and to meet us in Confederation Park now and after the ceremony. We will be gathering there in solidarity, and we hope you will join us. Thank you.
Jill Gard, one of the members of Artists for Liberation, spoke with CFRC outside of City Hall after the demonstration. I was going to ask why you think it's important that our mayor specifically make a statement.
Mm-hmm. So Mayor Brian Patterson represents, you know, the Kingston community at large and the different communities that make up this vibrant, you know, city. And so for Mayor Brian Patterson to make a statement on behalf of the city of Kingston in favor of a ceasefire, lasting permanent ceasefire in Palestine, it's a gesture that will increase knowledge of the crisis, will increase, you know, public opinion in favor of the Palestinian cause and Palestinian liberation. And, you know, there's no such thing as all of our choices and the decisions that we make and the ways that we communicate have a ripple effect. So for Mayor Brian Patterson to make a statement would hopefully continue that ripple effect of other cities, other legislators, MPs, MPPs, and so on and so forth. You know, as we just saw, like one of the esteemed artists, Hillworth, who, you know, we see very highly, it started this campaign, He Has No Home Here, and it was eventually brought to the House of Commons. And this was like a small community initiative that grew and grew and grew and now is, you know, internationally recognized. So we see the value of, you know, making public statements in, you know, the socio-political realm, if that makes sense.
Why did you feel the need to make a statement tonight specifically at the Mirror Arts Awards?
So basically the collective of folks that is involved in this demonstration today, we're all artists, multidisciplinary visual artists, we have performers, we have, you know, actors, theater reviewers, and so being all artists ourselves, we want to remind the mayor that art can be a catalyst for social change and justice, even for causes that the municipal government does not prioritize, such as the ceasefire in Palestine that we're advocating for.
And do you feel your message was received tonight?
The mayor himself was not present for our statement. He left the room before we could make it because the city of Kingston was somehow made aware of our demonstration in advance. And so he chose not to be there and receive our statement, which is disappointing to us. However, the attendees and the Arts Award winners, you know, I made eye contact with many of them, and it felt well received. And you know, we were surprisingly applauded afterwards, which I certainly did not expect. And so, I'm hopeful, and I'm bolstered by the reaction from the crowd, which is, you know, a crowd of really like community-minded and compassionate folks that many of us know already. So that was reassuring, even though we did not unfortunately achieve our goal of having them here. Listen to our plea, which is essentially what it was. It wasn't a demand. It was an ask, and it was a plea.
Asgard stated Mayor Brian Patterson did exit the room prior to the demonstration. Following a request from CFRC for comment from Mayor Patterson or the city on the demonstration, the city responded matter-of-factly, stating, quote, city staff had been informed that there was a protest that would be taking place after the presentation of the Mayor's Arts Awards. The protest did occur. It was brief and included a protester reading a prepared statement. The protesters then left, and the event was able to continue on as intended, celebrating the artists and organizations receiving the awards, end quote. Tomorrow, on January 30th, Kingston's Real Out Queer Film Festival will be kicking off their 26th year, featuring a new shorts program in partnership with the Kingston Frontenac Public Library and the addition of new forms of media. Over the next 10 days, Real Out is offering 18 programs from over 45 filmmakers, media artists, game designers, and performing artists from 14 different countries. To discuss this year's festival and their new programming, CFRC spoke with Real Out Executive Director Matt Salton. We're following up last year's 25th anniversary celebrations. What can folks look forward to this year?
Well, this year we are, our theme this year is Rays of Light. And that came about primarily because, things are feeling a bit dark. I think we're all feeling a little bit scared about the current political climate and feel like we're going into sort of like the looming shadow of Mordor or Voldemort or insert supernatural baddie here. and so we thought, well, Real Out's always been this little slice of sanity for a lot of people. And it's sort of like a 10 days of immersing yourself in this ecology of independent film and sort of, you know, feel good vibes and, you know, equity and diversity and kindness. And so, sort of playing on the fact that all of these motion pictures are actually like rays of light. So, that's where we kind of went with that. And we have 18 different programs being offered over 10 days between the 30th of January and February 8th. Most of them are at the screening room downtown. This year, something new. We are having a little short film festival. It's 4 days, Monday through Thursday, at 6 o'clock each night. There's a different thematic shorts program playing at the central branch of the Kingston Public Library.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit to where that collaboration kind of came from.
Well, I think the library has always been a wonderful supporter of Reel Out, and they always put together an amazing a display of books and films on their own website. And this year, we had reached out to them to see if they would be interested in collaborating, because they have a lovely space upstairs that is still wheelchair accessible. And it's kind of nice to have like a different venue, so we're not all in one place. And we just thought it was a lovely fit, and they've been wonderful to work with. Liz at the library in particular has been such a lovely help. We're really excited to have that there. And the Friends of the Library have offered free tickets. So if you go to their website, they're offering free tickets that the library has paid for people to come see the short films if they don't have the money, which is wonderful. And there'll be like some free snacks for people as well.
Getting organized this year, is there anything that you're doing differently, or is it more about just, you know, preserving that tradition, providing that space that you guys always provide every year?
This year, we are going to have different video games in the lobby of the screening room. So anytime the festival's at the screening room, we'll have a different video game every night, and they are designed by Canadian artists around the topics of gender and sexual orientation. And this was something that was originally curated through InterAccess, the gallery in Toronto, last summer for the Vector Film, the Vector Festival, Media Arts Festival. I was fortunate enough to be there for it, and I just had such a great time. And I thought, how can we bring this to Reel Out? And so instead of having like a big room with lots of video games, we'll just have one video game each night in the lobby, and people can play it. It's free to play. And it's great fun. We just tested them this morning. Great way to spend your Monday morning.
Awesome. Yeah, I was wondering if you could dive a bit more into providing that different format.
Well, I guess like I think it was, I mean, this is kind of a drag, but this year, a lot of not-for-profits charities had to comply with like new government rules. And so a lot of that was going back and looking at like our mission statement, our bylaws, our articles of incorporation. And when we were looking through ours, I was thinking like we're classified as a media arts festival. And that can mean pretty much anything that's created through sort of technological means, including video games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, we only really focus on film. Why don't we try and do something different, mix it up? And a friend of mine who is, you know, works at the InterAccess Gallery, I asked her, by any chance, do you have any queer video game designers? And she said, well, you know, funny you should ask. We have a whole program about that coming up. So that's how that all came about.
Yeah, and what are some of the games that might be featured in there?
So we have like, there's five different video games. Some of them, like for one, for example, is made through Roblox. So people who might be familiar with Roblox should find this kind of interesting. There's sort of navigational games. There's like role play games where like there's like a video chat where you just kind of play around with that. There's some that are like that have, I don't want to spoil anything, so like you can, mm-hmm. you choose whether or not you play as like your gender, you choose your gender and then you navigate dating. There is a stealth game called Flaccid that we played that was a lot of fun that requires a remote control where you sort of navigate a trans body, in the words of the game designer, a trans fat body. And then you navigate that character down a road where very large and looming words and labels come towards you, and you have to sort of literally navigate around those words in order to get to your destination. It's a hoot. We're really looking forward to seeing people play these games, and They're very rudimentary as well. Like, this is part of a work. It was part of a larger workshop. So don't expect Super Mario Brothers, but also I think some will surprise people.
You spoke about this at the start, but I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into the importance of this event specifically this year and at this time.
The festival, so I joined the festival in year two. So I had been at the first festival that was organized by a local artist and activist, Marnie McDermid, as well as Susan Lord and a few other people from Queens and also from the town. And I saw myself represented for the first time authentically. And my brand of activism, I didn't know what my brand of activism was, other than like I recently came out and I really liked film. And I realized this was a great way to invigorate myself, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I joined the committee, the collective, in 2000. And here I am running the organization years later. Although the political climate has changed, it's also now regressing. And I can feel that. I think a lot of us can feel that have lived through this before, especially in the States. But also it seems like it's right around the corner, breathing down our necks here in Canada. So I think we have to be hypervigilant, and I think like we have to really value the spaces that we create for our communities. And, you know, like I have to, you know, acknowledge, you know, that I am, you know, a white, cis, you know, gay male, but like I have to acknowledge that there are a lot of people in our community who are really already feeling the pain and pressure. You know, a lot of queer people of color, obviously a lot of trans, non-binary, gender non-conforming folks are really being attacked right now. And we have to be allies, and we have to be able to create these spaces for these folks, or just not even create them, but for those folks to feel like they can just take them. So, you know, don't wait for, you know, for us to create these spaces. They're going out and taking them. I think that's what we need to do. And then for our programming, it's the same thing. It's like, who do we, you know, we had over 400 submissions from all over the world. So our programming committee, which is, you know, a handful of people who are, you know, reflective of our audience, we said, who are we making this festival for? Right? Do we show a film about Trans 101 where we show someone, you know, taking tea, or, you know, hoping for, you know, gender reassignment surgery, or watching the surgery, you know, all of these things that we see time and time again, but we can also watch that on National Geographic or, you know, whatever, the WB. Like, these stories become familiar and very accessible, and also paints a very limited picture of trans bodies, for example. And so we look for films that are not made for cis straight audiences, but in fact for the audiences that we were meant to create this festival for in the first place.
Once again, that was Executive Director Matt Sultan on this year's Real Out Queer Film Festival. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Coming up next is CFRC's afternoon lineup. At noon, we have Democracy Now!, syndicated daily global news with Amy Goodman. At 1 p.m., join Corey and Madeline for Close Reads. At 2 p.m., we have Whiplash Anything and Everything with DJ LFN. Stay tuned for these programs and so much more right here on CFRC.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Left-Handed Archer's newest single, Haunted by the Ghosts of Elephants That Died There, a song that combines rich, expressive rhythms with immersive soundscapes to elicit a sense of exploration and disorientation, like a climber delving deeper and deeper into an unexplored cave, unaware of what might be lurking inside. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Haunted by the Ghosts of Elephants That Died There by Left-Handed Archer on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us right now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Save him from beauty, because he says there is too much beauty.